It's time. It's time to open your eyes. It's time to open your mind. It's time to grow up and face reality. It's time to lock and load because it's Meat Trapper time. Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Meat Trapper Radio. Now we have a very special show for you tonight, and one that I'm sure you're going to enjoy. We have a guest host for tonight's show, and the guest host is a good friend of mine, Mr. Judson Carroll. And many of you have heard me mention him before on Meat Trapper Radio. Judson is a very prolific writer of all things Southern and all things food. You can check out his blog at reclaimingsouthernfood.blogspot.com. And Judson also runs a couple of Facebook groups that you need to check out. One is called Southern Food. One is called How to Get Out of the Rat Race and Live on $10 a Month, which is named after a great George Herder classic book. And then he also runs one on net tying and trap making. I'll put links to all of these resources in the show notes below. But without further ado, take it away, Judson.
Hey, y'all. My name's Judson Carroll, and it's a real honor for me to be able to help out with Meat Trapper Radio today. I met Tim online a couple years ago, and since then we've become pretty good friends. We got a lot in common. Turns out our great-great-great or so grandfathers were very likely prisoners of war together when they were fighting for the Confederacy. I believe they both ended up in Elmira, only mine didn't make it quite all the way. He contracted dysentery on board ship and was thrown overboard to drown. So I guess you'd say I'm American by birth and Southern by the grace of God, as Louis Grizzard used to say, and I think we got a lot of good things going on down here, especially when it comes to our fish and game, our woods, our water, our food. You know, our traditions run deep here. My family's been here since long before America was a nation, and I really love the American South. Now, I know we got a lot of folks listening to this all over the world, and plenty of y'all up north. I know especially fur trapping is just amazing up y'all's way. We don't get the same quality of fur down here, and well, really, that's one of the main reasons my focus is mainly food. I love food. You could say I'm almost obsessed with it. I remember when Tim first mentioned me on his show, he read an email and said something that I didn't even remember writing. He said that I had written that my passion was going out in the woods and on the water and bringing home food, bringing home something I can cook, because I honestly believe, I know it for a fact, I can get better food out of the woods than I can buy in any grocery store, than I can get in any restaurant. Now, I love to cook, so a lot of times I like cooking even better than eating. And I cook some pretty darn good food, so that's saying a lot, let me tell you. My family's half French, about half Irish, plenty of English. The French that came in, my great-great-great, I think it's like seven great-grandfathers, his name was Chevalier Dubuisson. He was a cousin of Lafayette, so they were the House of Bourbon. His son settled down on the Cape Fear River in North Carolina, and you can imagine that was some pretty high-class French food. Well, that all got mixed together down in the swamps of North Carolina with all that good Scots-Irish cooking, all the good, and there is some good English cooking, believe it or not. Regardless of what people say, the English make some phenomenal sausages, and if you were to look at our southern breakfast, I remember growing up on the farm, my grandmother, she would lay out food like you would not believe for a farm breakfast. And we are talking eggs and grits and toast and cucumbers and tomatoes and sausage and bacon and honey right out of my great-grandfather's hives and fresh butter and coffee and, I mean, oh my gosh. We're talking cantaloupe, watermelon. I can't believe I used to eat that way. I still am a big eater, but the stuff we put away back then, it carried you on a farm. And I didn't even live on the farm. And I ate like that back then. I don't know how I did it, to tell you the truth. But anyway, I think that really does give me a different perspective, is my perspective really is the food. Now, I have to say, I think most of our natural resources, our God-given resources, are being just going to waste. People have lost their common sense. Now, some of y'all older folks may remember the Herder's catalog. George Herder had a company called Herder's. I think it was Waseca. I don't really know how to pronounce that town. It was the predecessor to Bass Pro Shop and Outdoor World. It was sort of like the Sears catalog for hunters and trappers and fishermen. He was an amazing man. I would consider him a very eccentric genius. He said one time, people don't starve because of lack of food. They starve because of lack of knowledge. And I think he was absolutely right about that. We are surrounded by just incredible resources. Right now I'm sitting down here in Sand Hills in North Carolina. I'm just here for a little bit. There's really no public land around here to hunt or trap. They even fence off the creek side of the road so you can't go fishing. It's absolutely ridiculous. Nothing around here but golf courses and retired Yankees. And again, I've got nothing against Yankees per se, but just to put it bluntly, I don't fit in around here. But looking around me, just in the past week, the vegetables, the vegetation, the greens coming up that I can forage around here, I mean, they're sheep sorrel. Look, you go into any grocery store, any high-class grocery store in America, and just about any grocery store in Europe, you're going to see sorrel for sale, minimum $6, $10 a pound. We called it sour weed when I was a kid on the farm. We just pull that stuff up and chew on it. We didn't even know about the greens. That's sorrel. That's a good salad green. It's a good pot herb. It's everywhere. You can look it up online. Curly dock is growing everywhere. It looks a lot like sheep sorrel, but bigger, longer leaves, delicious stuff. Plantain, and these are things that are not native to America. Okay, they were brought here by our ancestors. Europeans brought over dandelions for food. Dandelion greens are delicious. Dandelion roots make a tea that has all kinds of health benefits. Dandelion flowers can be made into wine. Now, what are people doing with dandelions in America? Killing them. Why? Because for some reason we want grass. What do you do with grass except look at it? I mean, think about it. Whole dang, basically, agriculture, horticulture program here in North Carolina has moved away from growing food to growing turf. You know where that came from? It came from an American imitation of an English garden that was basically somebody saying, look, I'm so rich, I don't have to grow food. I'm only going to have something pretty to look at in my front yard. And they might have a little garden around back because they were ashamed of it. Or maybe somebody in the family had enough sense to say, I want to go out and get some nice greens to put on the table, or pull an onion, or, you know, whatever. But it makes no sense. You know, Tim got me listening to Trapping Radio, and it's been a joy, honestly. I've listened to every show that Clint's ever done, Chip's ever done, and I mean, archive going way back. And it's been just so great to know people actually think like me somewhere in this world, and I think a lot of y'all probably feel the same way too. Clint's got me his show has gotten me into permaculture. I'm now studying to become a permaculture design consultant. It just makes sense. Bill Mollison, who started this whole permaculture thing, said that, and I have not looked it up, but Jeff Lawson said the same thing years later and pointed to a paper that I really should look up, because the Permaculture Research Institute, I think is what it's called, has proven that all the world's food, all of our agricultural products, could be produced on 1/6 the amount of acreage currently being used. Now, I find that absolutely amazing, but think about what they're saying. What permaculture does is imitates the woods. It imitates the pasture or the field going up to the woods. Now, I can walk out in the woods, and I love doing this, I've done it my entire life, and hunt for wild mushrooms. I take the old Audubon field guide with me. There's another great book called Mushrooms Demystified, and another one that's got great pictures called 100 Wild Edible Mushrooms. You just go out there and you look around. Morels are coming up right now. There are places, especially the foothills of Tennessee, foothills of North Carolina, all up Virginia and everywhere. I saw some pictures this morning, some folks posting just huge morels down in Alabama. I know they grow in Illinois. They probably grow about everywhere. I know Pennsylvania, they have tons of them up that way. Right now, they're going for about $50 a pound in the store. Now, I want you to think about this for a minute, because Tim said something this morning, got me thinking. He said, you know, it's summer, it's hard to come up with topics about trapping. Well, that is true, unless you're, you know, lucky enough to live in Tennessee and you got that nice spring squirrel season. We don't have that here. That's a topic for another day. We don't have a fall turkey season here either, so you can't get your turkey to go on your table. Another topic for another day. But anyway, you go into the woods, and you have all these wonderful edible mushrooms that are so valuable. So valuable. I mean, those morels, you're talking anywhere between $30 and $70 a pound, depending on where they're being sold. I can go in the woods. Last fall, went in the woods, harvested chanterelles. About the same price, not quite as expensive. Just amazing. Nice, meaty bolets. These wild mushrooms are everywhere, and all they take is a little bit of knowledge, learning to do something called a spore print. You take the cap off, you sit down on a white piece of paper, come back the next day, it will have dropped its spores on that paper, at least something that's identical to a fingerprint. If you're not 100% sure you can identify that mushroom by sight, you do a spore print. It turns out to be the mushroom you want. You go back the next day and you harvest those mushrooms. Take them down to a farmer's market. Take them anywhere you want where somebody will buy them. And you've made money off a resource you didn't even know you had on your property. You think about those wild greens I was talking about. All right, so let's say you're out there in the woods. And you're picking mushrooms or you're foraging for ramps. Oh my gosh, I just picked so many ramps about a week ago up in the mountains of North Carolina. Went down by a spring creek bed. It's fed by a little spring up there, and the ramps are just all over the banks. I mean, they just come up too, so they're young and tender. Ramps are a wild leek. They're just phenomenally good. Cooked, they're very delicate onion flavor. Raw, they don't have a bite or a hot punch like an onion. They don't really have a sweetness per se like a cultivated leek, but the flavor is just so strong. I mean, you will taste those ramps. If you like onions, you love ramps because you go on taste them for about an hour. And if you eat them raw, you will start smelling like ramps, which is about the only drawback to them. I don't much care myself. So you start thinking about these resources. And it reminded me of a book called Resources of the Southern Fields and Forests. Now back during the Civil War, the North put a blockade around the South. We couldn't get anything imported from any other country. Also couldn't, of course, get anything that was coming from the North. So the Confederate government commissioned a French botanist to find replacements that grow here naturally for every single thing that we were importing or buying from somewhere else. He wrote this huge book. I mean, I don't even remember how long it was. I haven't read it in years, but it's like maybe 700 pages. We're talking food, textiles, dyes, medicines, a whole chapter on even making opium. I mean, he even figured out how to replace our pain medicines and said the South could be the, you know, richest area in the country because we're such a good place to grow poppies. That's probably the only reason the book stayed in print this long, is people always have an interest in narcotics. Again, I don't myself. I'm more interested in food, but I highly recommend that book, and I imagine this stuff probably grows throughout the continental United States and just about everything in there except the tropical or subtropical fruits and such, probably grow well up into Canada. When you think about how our ancestors looked at the resources of the land, I mean, this is a land of plenty. People didn't go to grocery stores. I remember listening one time to Justin Wilson, the old Cajun cook, grew up watching him. And he said they called the swamps of Louisiana the swamp grocery store. They'd set out a couple of traps. He'd set out a couple of trot lines. They'd go foraging. They'd come back. They had a critter. They had some vegetables. They had all the food they needed. Now what's changed? We've lost our common sense. I was back down here a couple of years ago, and I went out and walked the dog. I got a little border collie, you know how active they are. He has to be walked around here an awful lot. Got down the street, and there's a fella pulling out wild grapevines. I mean, he had this incredible resource of grapes growing around his property, and he's out there with a Roundup and a pickaxe going at it, actually. And I said, looks like you're working hard. And he said, yeah. He said, these vines, they're just killing me. I got to get rid of them. I said, well, don't you like the grapes? And he says, what? I said, the grapes, don't you like them? They're good to eat. He said, you can't eat those. I said, why not? He said, well, how do you know they're not poisonous? And I just kind of said, well, because they're grapes. You know, they're grapes. A grape isn't poisonous. It's a grape. But to him, a grape is something you buy in the grocery store. Now, that's down here. Now, I've been up in the mountains. Now, I grew up about halftime in the mountains and toward the coast and the swamps. I was up in the mountains. This happened many times. And you find a lot of wild blueberry bushes up there. Wonderful things. Buckshot blueberries, they're called. Little tart, packed full of flavor. Anyway, I'm on a trail up there, and I start picking a handful of blueberries. And I'm out there with experienced hikers, hunters, outdoorsmen. And they say, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm eating blueberries. How do you know they're not poisonous? Because they're blueberries. You can look at them and know they're blueberries. But for some reason, people become so convinced that their food has to come from a store that they won't trust their own common sense and personal experience. You know, I was looking on Facebook the other day, and someone had a picture of a wild strawberry and said, my grandchild just ate this. Should I rush her to the hospital? It was a strawberry. You know, no, it wasn't a nice big grocery store strawberry, but it had strawberry leaves on it. It was red. It was a strawberry. Now, you know, that's not the way my great-grandparents or my grandparents or I think. You know, I was probably maybe 3 years old, walked over and started picking blackberries. What did my mother say? Hey, blackberries, let's take them home and make a pie. She didn't post a picture on Facebook and ask if I needed to be rushed to the hospital. No, actually, I was pretty bad for eating just about anything, and she had to keep a bottle of Epicac around because I was constantly poisoning myself, so maybe I've always had a little bit of a taste for wild food. But my point is, we've lost our common sense. We're not making use of this incredible resource, and it's all around us, and it's free. You know, a couple weeks ago, Clint said something on his show about people who make the most money usually make it off of a natural resource. They find something that God put here free for our use, and they figure out how to sell it. Now, look out your back door. What do you see? Well, if you're in the city, maybe, you know, not as much as what I see, okay? But you are surrounded by free food. If it walks, flies, swims, or grows, just double check it isn't poisonous. And that's really not hard. I mean, you can get the Peterson Field Guide. You can get old Bradford Angier's Field Guide. I love his books. He was sort of like George Herder, a little bit eccentric. It's with the resources we have online now, the internet, it is so easy to identify these plants. You don't really need to ask, you know, can I eat it so much as does it taste good? And most of these things taste really, really good. Another green I was seeing the other day was lamb's quarters. That's wild spinach. Wild spinach, just out there, free for the picking. People just driving right by it, not paying any attention to it. You know, Well, and that reminds me, one of my Facebook groups called How to Get Out of the Rat Race and Live on $10 a Month. It's named after an old George Herder book. And I've been doing a series on there about foraging. I think I've posted about 16 different wild fruits and greens and various things. And I'm updating that every day. Every day I put it out there. I give a description of it. I tell you how to use it. I post pictures. I find articles other people have written about that specific plant. Recipes, YouTube videos where someone's going out and showing you how to do it. I do one of those a day. Y'all are welcome to join that. And please participate. I'm tired of being about the only one that posts. But, like I said to Tim this morning, once I get started talking, it's hard to shut me up. But anyway, we really aren't taking advantage of our natural resources. And when you look at, human history, we wouldn't have gotten this far if we had been so ignorant about what was around us. I mean, the Bible says, let every seed growing herb go into the nourishment of your bodies. It says, be stewards of the earth. Now, what's a steward? A steward is not someone that sets aside tracts of land or certain areas, species, whatever, and says, you can't eat this, you can't touch it, you can't go on it. All right, we are covered, especially around here, by herds of malnourished, small, basically starving deer because they don't have enough protein-rich food to eat, and there's no one around here to cull those populations. We should not even have a limit on deer this year, or certainly not last year, the year before that. I don't know what the next year may hold. But, you know, go to your state Department of Environmental Resources or whatever you call it, fish and game in your state. I was looking at the one for Georgia just the other day, and the wording really struck me when I looked at the code of law. I'm just paraphrasing here. I don't have it in front of me, but said, the fish and game of the state of Georgia shall be considered property of the state of Georgia, and access to it regulated and granted by the officials of the Georgia Fish and Game or whatever it was. Now, look it up and verify it. I think it says about the same thing in every state. Now, I don't know about y'all, but I don't remember voting on that. I got a constitution, state constitution and a federal constitution. I don't see the power given to them in either of those documents. Seems to me, in the land of the free and the home of the brave, quite often we're in the situation of poaching the king's deer. The king just is replaced by the state. That isn't right. Now, yes, populations need to be managed. Yes, they were put under far too much pressure during the Great Depression. That was regional. It was not nationwide. I don't see why that couldn't have been dealt with regionally. You know, I love old country music, and Jimmy Rogers had a song called No Depression, and it was about Southerners on the farm didn't experience the Great Depression, said, I got no depression, I got chickens in my backyard. They were still making use of those natural resources. Now, you know, chicken's not a wild bird, but I guarantee they were going out fishing and hunting, and they weren't as affected as people in cities and, you know, in more higher, denser population areas. I'm, you know, working in the food realm, I guess you'd say. I mean, I'm a food writer. I do occasionally cook. Barbecue is kind of a specialty, of course, being from North Carolina. But I communicate with people all over the world. You know, everybody loves food. Everybody loves to eat. We trade recipes and all kinds of stuff. And it's really funny sometimes how people view America and American food. Now, you know, I'm just as red-blooded and patriotic as anybody, but I can't say we always do everything right, and I think food is a real good place to look where we could improve things. Talking with a fellow in England the other day, and he just flat out asked me, he said, you know, Americans are always bragging about being free and having all these individual rights and liberties, but here in England, I can go to the market and buy wild game. I can walk into the grocery store or open market. I think he was even talking oh, what's that huge department store over there? Harrods? I don't remember. Anyway, this is one of the most upscale department stores in the entire world. They also have the absolute finest grocery store probably in the world. And one whole section of it is nothing but wild game. They got rabbits hanging up. They got pheasants hanging up. Farmers can bring in the rabbit they shot that morning. They sell it to the grocery store. The grocery store sells it to the customer. A game warden that's managing a large property brings in a bunch of pheasants. Deer. You know, someone shoots a deer. They don't need it for their family. They sell it. It gets resold. That's illegal in most places in America, in the land of the free and the home of the brave. You know, it reminds me of a fellow I went to school with, an exchange student from Germany. I think he's about 16 years old. And he's sitting there one day, he said, I haven't had a beer in a week. This is the first time in my life I haven't had a beer in a week. What is wrong with you people? You know, they don't have a drinking age in Germany like we have here. I don't know if they don't have one at all, but by the time he was 16, he was able to have a beer. He said, why is it that at 18, an American can be given a gun and sent off to defend freedom and liberty, but he's not free enough to buy a beer until he's 21 or responsible enough? What is wrong with you people? I don't have an answer for that either. You know, I also don't have an answer for why we can't sell unpasteurized milk. I got a friend in Ukraine. I like to make cheese. She's a cheesemaker as well. She sent me a recipe. It specified it had to be made with raw cow's milk, unpasteurized. I told her, I said, it'll be a while. Maybe next time I'm passing through South Carolina, I can buy some. They just recently legalized the sale of unpasteurized milk in South Carolina, because it's illegal to buy raw milk in North Carolina. I may have been living in Virginia at the time. Either way, it was illegal. She was amazed. She said, even under the Soviets, and if y'all know anything about history, the Soviet Union, one of the worst genocides ever was what the Soviet Union did to Ukraine. They basically tried to starve the people to death. Nearly succeeded. She said, even under the Soviets, they took our food, but they didn't tell us we had to boil it before it was eaten. How is your nation a free nation? I didn't have an answer. You know, if we're not free to eat what we want, what freedoms do we have? Another one that comes to mind is just kind of funny, and it just illustrates how we've really lost our common sense. A fellow I was talking to one time, he said he was talking with a French lady, and he's a chef. And he said, why is it the French have such a low regard for American cooks and cooking? He said, we really have some of the finest restaurants, finest cooks here, anywhere in the world. And she looked at him and she said, because you buy breadcrumbs and croutons. Now think about that. Everywhere else in the world, you want breadcrumbs, you take a stale piece of bread and crumble it up. You're making a casserole. You're doing your old, you know, chicken casserole or tuna casserole. You want the breadcrumbs on the top? Crumble them up. You want croutons? Take a piece of bread, cut it in a square, fry it in butter. We've gotten so beyond common sense that we are paying someone to take their stale bread, crumble it up, and sell it to us. You can't fix stupid, and in all honesty, that level of stupidity is so widespread, I don't even know how to wrap my mind around it. You know, going back to saying about how the populations of game and such have to be managed, and I agree they do, but I think we've gone way too far with it. Clint was recently in Thailand. He was talking about their markets. I like to watch Andrew Zimmern's Bizarre Foods. He goes to all these places in Asia, and you know, these people have markets full of wild game and fish. There are people making a living hunting and fishing for a living, trapping for a living, and selling it to other people for food. These are places with far fewer resources than the United States. I mean, you're talking these little tiny Asian countries with millions and millions of people stacked on top of each other, with nowhere near the vast amount of land and resources we have. but they're free to hunt and fish and trap for a living and sell it as food. Here in America, you could take the entire population of the United States and fit it into Texas and give everybody about 4 acres. Think about that. Everybody in this country from the Atlantic to the Pacific, including Alaska and Hawaii, could be resettled in Texas. We have no shortage of land. We have no shortage of food. What we have is a shortage of common sense, and we need to start doing something about that. Now, I just want to address one other thing before I forget about it. Last week on Clint's show, he mentioned an email exchange we had had about growing truffles, and that's something I looked into years ago back when my family's farm was being sold. The state of North Carolina at that point was offering some subsidies for people who had been tobacco farmers to transition into another crop. And one of those that was being suggested was truffles. There's a place called Garland Truffles. It's up in Eflin, North Carolina. They really pioneered growing truffles in the United States. They've been very successful. And I forgot to mention to Clint, one of their customers is, if I remember correctly, either in Limestone or Chucky, Tennessee, just up the road from him a bit. They've got a very, very nice truffle farm in that heavy limestone soil, which is very much like the regions where the truffles are native in France. But they specialize in the black Perigord truffle and the burgundy truffle. They don't do the white truffle. I was mistaken about that. There are several varieties of white truffle that are native to the United States. One is, I think, the Oregon truffle. And the other one grows on pecan trees, pecan trees, as they say in Georgia. I went to the University of Georgia, where they don't even give you a diploma if you can't say pecan. But I grew up in North Carolina, in an area where everybody said pecan for no apparent reason. So anyway, it is doable to grow truffles. It's a big investment. From what I understand, they recommend several acres, and they have these small trees that are inoculated on the roots with the truffle spores. I believe it's filberts or hazelnuts. I think they may also do oaks. They have to be planted very densely. It seems, and I'm going from memory here, you plant 4 of them in 10 square feet, basically, you know, on the corner. You set up a grid pattern. The roots spread out. The roots take the mycelium into the soil, and it then colonizes the soil. They basically grow near the roots of trees, not necessarily on the roots of the trees. But it's pretty expensive. You need a good chunk of land. You need to buy a lot of seedlings. Then you have to wait, I think it's 10 years before they start producing. And then you got to get a dog that's trained. I did learn to say dog in Georgia. You know, they won't give you your diploma then either if you can't say dog, and Ugga will bite you. But before harvest comes, you have to have a dog to find them. And then, yes, they are incredibly valuable. They are incredibly expensive. But I have another suggestion. Now, I have not begun growing mushrooms commercially myself. I believe the fellow's name is Jesse, who asked Clint about it, and he does. So he actually may have more information on this than I do as far as the how to do it. Now, I have done it on small scale, just going out in the woods, finding some mushrooms, scattering them on some mulch in the backyard. Hit or miss results. You know, when you're talking about growing something commercially, you're doing it in sterile conditions because you want to know exactly what you're putting into it, exactly what you're going to get out of it. Were it me, even if I were looking at funding a truffle growing operation by doing this, I would really look into porcinis. I've had porcinis, I've had truffle oil, various things. They're very similar in taste. It's just the truffle is stronger. Truffle is more aromatic. But as far as if you had an essence of porcini and an essence of black truffle, you probably couldn't tell them apart. Now, porcinis are bolets. They will grow on a regular substrate, just like your oyster mushrooms would. It's usually sawdust or straw. I think oat husks, you know, stuff like that. They grow nice, big, probably about twice the size of your hand, I mean, one good-sized porcini, you got a good pound of mushroom there. And I believe they're going for about around 30 bucks a pound last time I saw them. They can be dried, they can be infused in oil, and you could really get some of those going in a very small space, like in a garage or an outbuilding, if you can control the humidity and the temperature, and you know, use that to buy your land and buy your seedlings and everything to start that truffle farm. Because if you do, you're also starting a market. When you have those porcinis and you're ready to sell them, you're going to various grocers or wholesalers or especially really high-end restaurants, and you're going to get that market established. And, you know, then maybe while you're talking with them, you say, hey, you know, I got some sorrel growing in my yard. I got some dock. You want to be the only restaurant in the area I sell that to exclusively at $10 a pound? I got ramps growing down by the creek. You know, the world's your oyster. And speaking of oysters, I think if I get the opportunity to do this next time, I'll do a show on harvesting some of the lesser known types of seafood and shellfish. That's something else I'm really into. So until next time, thanks for the opportunity, Tim.
Beneath the summer sun, my dusky eyes met his soul blue. Our soaring spirits breathed as one. We blazed our love across the sky, surrendered to its ancient force, until the day he said goodbye and climbed aboard the Iron Horse. Heard its challenge loud and shrill as we chased it off the great divide. But though my steed had the stronger will, the Iron Horse had the longer stride. Whistle cut me like a blade, I loathed screaming, spooky cry. How could he leave his Indian maid? I'll ride like wind and ask him why. Astride my fearless painted dun, I chose my pace and set my course. To catch this demon on the run, my steed against this iron horse. Heard its challenge loud and shrill as we chased it up the great divide. And though my steed had the stronger will, the Iron Horse had the longer stride. Stride. Through the thunder of its blare, I yelled my fury at the beast. Wasted words lost in the air as it roared its way forever east. And the iron horse's speed increased.